You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Cheers, MOTAT, and kia ora, Marcus.
Kia ora, how are you?
I'm good. So first up, we're talking about rushing science out of the fear of being scooped. It sounds like there's this fear that scientists are rushing to be first to publish their research, and that's making them take shortcuts.
Yeah, so this is quite an interesting little model. Scientists tend to want to work in the areas of highest impact, and so there tends to be sort of a race to get results in a particular area, and those areas change over time, obviously, as we advance science. But very often, there's a bit of a race to see who can publish first or to get some good results out, and then you sort of put a flag in your ground and this is your area of research. So there is this results of a study that's been done to try and analyze what the effect of that is, that rush for data or rush for publication. And the outcome of that is that rewarding researchers who publish first pushes them to cut corners. So if they get prestige or access to grant money or whatever from publishing first, then often it's done with a bit of shoddy science. So this is based on a sort of a digital model that was built, and it sort of had a toy world of about 120 scientists. And these were bots competing for rewards, publishing papers, doing research, and things like that. And each scientist in the simulation worked away, collected data on a series of research questions, and they were programmed. Each of the bots were programmed with different strategies. Some were more likely than others to collect large, meaningful data sets, and some tended to abandon a research question if someone else published on it first, whereas others held on sort of stubbornly. Yeah. And as they made discoveries and published, they accrued rewards, and those with the most rewards passed on their methods more often to the next generation. So maybe not surprisingly, if there's a reward for publishing first, the scientists who maybe collected a little bit less data, weren't quite as thorough in their research, got the reward, and that sort of propagated that attitude. So when they gave bots bigger rewards for publishing first, the populations tended to rush research, collect less data, and that led to research filled with shaky results and maybe not so reliable. But when the difference in reward wasn't so high, the scientists tended to veer towards larger sample sizes and slower publishing pace, so sort of better quality science. The simulations allowed them to test out the effects of reforms to improve the quality of scientific research. So the PLOS, PLOS journals, family of journals, and some other journals as well, offer what they call a scoop protection. So they give researchers the chance to publish their work even if they come in second. Right. 'Cause very often if you found a particular thing and you publish on it, and the next person to find that particular thing is maybe finds it much, much harder to publish because they say, well, this has been done. This has been published already. While there's no evidence yet from real world data, the model suggests that these sort of scoop protection schemes should work. So larger rewards for scooped research led the bots to settle on bigger data sets as their winning tactic. So if they weren't forced to publish first, they felt they didn't have to, then they could spend more time actually getting it right in the first place. But there was also a surprise. So maybe that's sort of predictable. But there was a bit of a surprise. So in science, we always talk about, or at least we tell our students, you know, record the data, do the analysis. And if the hypothesis is wrong or you have a negative result, that's just as valid as a positive result. Mm-hmm. And that's what we tell everyone. But very, very, very little science research is actually, we tried this and it didn't happen. Or we posed this hypothesis and it was wrong. Very, very little of that is actually published. It's only really the positive results, maybe understandably. but the model suggested rewarding researchers for publishing negative results without really focusing on research quality will suggest scientists to run the sort of the baddest or the crappiest studies that they can. So in other words, in the simulations, making it more difficult for scientists to run reams of low-cost studies help to correct that problem. So if it doesn't really matter if they get rewards for publishing positive and negative, then scientists will do everything, or at least these bots will do anything they can, get some data, even if it's wrong, they'll publish it, get the reward, and go forward. But if they make it more difficult for scientists to run lots and lots of little low-cost studies, often giving negative results, then that corrects that problem. Mm. And this points to the value of real-world reforms. Things like registered reports, which are sort of study plans peer-reviewed before the scientist does the study. So they make it, write a proposal, and that's peer-reviewed before they actually do the actual work. And that forces researchers to invest much more time and effort in at the start of the project, and discourages sort of a cherry picking of quick and easy data, quick and easy studies. So that was a sort of an illustration of how simulations like this could actually inform policy, I guess, or procedure in this area of science research.
Mm, that's very interesting. And next up is all about thumbs. Apparently thumbs are over 2 million years old.
Yeah, so this we've probably heard since we were kids that we have opposable thumbs. Yeah. And a lot of what makes us, you know, smarter and better at handling things is the fact that we can move our thumbs in sort of a unique way, and we have unique strength in our thumbs. So it's a distinguishing feature, but it's been a bit of a mystery when this unique digit, the thumb, evolved. And it's a bit difficult to try and tease that out because all we have in the fossils is evidence of bones. We don't really have evidence of where the muscles were. But a new study has tried to model where the muscles are and how they work in fossilized thumbs, and this suggests that the thumb is about 2 million years old. It turns out our ancestors evolved this thumb, whereas other closely related relatives didn't, or at least not to the same extent. It's not easy to do this. So fossils don't preserve muscles, like I said, and previous attempts to estimate ancient dexterity relied on how closely our ancient relatives' hand bones resembled our own. So if they look the same, they probably work the same. But that might be deceiving. Depending on how the muscles are connected, species with similar bones might have quite different grip strength and motion and things like that. So what they did to analyze ancient thumbs, a group of paleoanthropologists in Germany digitized fossil thumb bones from a variety of ancient homonyms. And these are groups that include all species in our own genus, Homo, as well as other very closely related species. So they looked at Neanderthals and a sister genus to Homo called the Australopithecines, which includes Australopithecus afarensis and a few other related sort of species. And they used 3D computer software to sort of reconstruct the fossils, and so they could move the thumb around and estimated or approximated where the muscles joined and what force they could exert. And to validate what they were doing, they took modern human hands and did the sort of same thing, and applied the same approach in the thumb bones, and they found that the force estimates with how much the thumb could push down and move were very similar to what was actually true. So they all the members in our genus Homo were investigated, and basically the same thumb grip strength as modern humans. So going back all the way 2 million years, they all had about the same thumb grip strength. They also found modern-looking thumb movement into homonym species from from a site in South Africa that were dated to about 2 million years. And the skeletons are not complete, so it's difficult to figure out what genus they belong to. Those represent the earliest known human-like thumbs with this sort of strength. But other human relatives in the study, Australopithecines, which I can barely say, had much, much weaker thumbs. And they found that their thumb strength was closer to modern chimpanzees, which don't have the same sort of range of motion and sort of grip strength. It seems like this branching about 2 million years ago, Australopithecines, who were related but not directly in our line of ancestry, didn't have this trait, and eventually they died out. Whereas modern humans or whatever these were in South Africa did have this thumb strength, and they propagated and eventually possibly became modern humans. Hmm. We treat these results with a bit of caution because the muscles they were looking at is only one of the muscles in the thumb. There are more than 10 different muscles that contribute to thumb movement. So it's possible that there are other ways that the muscles could have been attached in other species that could have compensated for the lack of strength in that particular muscle. But this is potentially a really useful approach because it allows us to really try and figure out, where this adaptation actually arose, or when it arose, I guess.
That's very interesting. A nice little look back at the history of our favorite fingers. So lastly, we've got this interesting questions about the intellectual property rights of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I saw this. I thought this was really, really quite cool. So AI, or artificial intelligence, seems to be a topic that's getting, maybe people are hearing about more and more. And these artificial intelligence machines are increasingly being used to solve problems of scientific interest or come up with new inventions. So in chemistry, for instance, which is my field, they're being used to often find chemical compounds that can be used as drugs. And the question is, if it's the AI, the artificial intelligence, that has basically done the work, found the compound, should it be the AI that's credited as being the inventor of that compound? Mm. Because effectively it found it.
Yeah.
There is a case that's currently going through the High Court in England and Wales, I believe, or it's just gone through the High Court. And this is a from an inventor whose artificial intelligence machine was called Dabus, D-A-B-U-S, and he says it was the sole inventor of two new discoveries. So the machine itself was the inventor. And these discoveries, I don't really know what they are, some sort of fractal container, whatever that means, and a neural flame. Again, I don't really know what they mean, but this guy alleges that the machine invented them. Mm-hmm. And although the authorities accept that this machine devised the inventions and that the inventions per se are patentable or patentable, the problem is this machine, Dabus, which is an acronym for Device for the Autonomous Bootstrapping of Unified Sentience, which is very complicated, it isn't a natural person, and under patent law, only a natural person can be identified as the inventor, and only a natural person can be granted a patent.
Is that specified within the law, that it has to be a natural person?
It looks like it, yes.
That's really interesting. I guess it sort of inadvertently acknowledges that personhood can be granted to non-natural beings,
right?
Which is very forward-thinking for whoever wrote that law.
Yeah. No, it is. And this is the first time that an AI inventor has been formally named in a patent application. And the case obviously throws up some pretty interesting questions more broadly for, inventions and patents in general, but also for the chemistry sector, which is actually a big user of artificial intelligence in discovering pharmaceuticals. Mm. And not just pharmaceuticals, but new chemical pathways, new chemicals, materials, fragrances, all sorts of things. So so the question is who's the inventor? Is it the machine, or is it the people who are running the machine, or maybe the people who are validating the results that the machine has sort of spit out? So there's really two camps here. So there's the example of a research scientist at Northwestern in the U.S., Northwestern University in the U.S., who's the lead machine learning engineer at Target, which is a big retail store in the U.S. And he runs a deep neural network, another name for like an artificial intelligence called LMNet, which leverages artificial intelligence to automatically predict the stability of new materials. So you just give them the elements, and it will predict a material and tell you how stable it is and what the properties are and things like that. So any new material candidates discovered by this AI can then be synthesized in a chemistry lab and then could have real-world applications and might then need to be patented. They would have to be experimentally validated, though, by a human scientist. So in those cases, the argument is that, okay, well, this machine has come up with this material, maybe invented it, but then it would have to be validated by some person.
Right.
So there's an argument the material was first invented by the computer, maybe, or was it invented? So there's another a patent attorney believes that there isn't yet a strong case to say AI is really an inventor. He says it's just there's school of thought that says AI is just a tool, and it's just to use to assist the inventing. So AI is a system that can generate invention insights, but a human still has to join the dots in the right way.
Yeah.
And so the inventions aren't by chance. The computer didn't just wake up, boot up one morning and go ping, and here's a new invention. Yeah. It had to be fed information. It had to be trained and before it could actually come up with the invention. So the idea is then that the AI is a facilitator of a discovery, but not the actual inventions. Until perhaps sometime in the future, if an AI robot then validated those results. So if the AI came up with the idea, and then the AI controlled a robot, or a different robot maybe, then validated the results, then that possibly should be patentable, because then there's little or no human intervention at all.
And I guess now these are the sorts of things that people have to think about to sort of, I guess, you know, not just stuff that's immediately relevant now, but, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now, when this stuff does actually develop.
Right. So it's a case of, again, law keeping up with progress. And the conundrum is when is AI no longer a tool? When is it sort of a non-natural person?
That's really interesting. Good thing to keep an eye on. All right. Well, thank you so much, Marcus, for joining us. We'll be right back after this.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.